This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 51 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Views expressed are not representative of the management of the Kinky Cast. In today's episode, we go in depth to 40 years of the kinky cinema. Here's your hosts, Woody and the Beast.
Thanks, Max, and welcome back to another edition of the Kinky Cast. This week, I have sitting across from me Beast Siskel, and I'm Woody Ebert on the Kinky Cinema Edition.
Good afternoon, world. We got an interesting cast for us today.
We are exploring the kinky cinema, which means mostly porn.
Well, we're starting with porn, starting with some great landmarks from the very early days, from the golden age of porn.
It was called the golden era back then. We had a couple competing factions that were really taking porn to the next level by bringing it into regular movie theaters and bringing a mainstream crowd to a very taboo series of subjects.
The 60s, I think, opened up a lot of things in America, and the theater goers were willing to experiment, and the production companies were stepping up. In 72, we had a couple of really groundbreaking films.
And so without any further ado, let's lead off with our number one film, which is Deep Throat.
Deep Throat, the story of Linda Lovelace.
It brought her from obscurity onto the mainstream.
It did indeed. There was considerable talk about this film when it was first released, and then many years later it came back for another round of conversation. But let's talk about the film when it was first released.
Well, it had Harry Reams as the good doctor. Harry Reams had quite a reputation.
Yes, he did. But this film was the first pornographic film to feature a plot. That's the reason it got into the cinemas across the country.
Even though it was shot in 16mm, it was blown up to 35mm for release into regular movie theaters.
I know, but they had something going here. It was banned across the country, of course, and our fair city, I'm sure, it never seen the light of day.
Well, I saw it in Hollywood at the Pussycat Theater with my wife and another couple, which is really odd, going to a porno movie that way.
Oh, but a lot of couples, I understand, went that way that day for that particular film.
So this came out June 12th, 1972. The budget for the film was $47,500.
And they claim that they made $600 million in the end.
And it's probably still making money.
Probably is. What is the copyright law on films?
I think it's 25 years.
25 years. This one's 72. This one's 32 years old, something like that.
A lot of these early films you can now catch on YouTube in their full run. And so on our main page for this episode, you will find links to everything that we talk about. You'll either see the trailers or the full piece on YouTube.
I'm looking at the Ebert review from this, and he actually reviewed this, gave it no stars. Of the lead character, Miss Lovelace, is all very well and good for Linda Lovelace, the star of the movie, to advocate sexual freedom, but the energy she brings to her role is less awesome than discouraging. If you have to work this hard at sexual freedom, maybe it isn't worth the effort.
Of course, that might be a little bit of a narrow review.
I think it was. I don't think that Ebert particularly was ready for the sex that came with this film and then later.
I was looking at the production notes here, and even though it claimed it made $600 million, using Hollywood accounting, they were able to cut it back between $30 and $50 million, which is an interesting way they do that to prevent from paying too many royalties, if anybody got royalties at all.
At all. And I believe, if I remember hearing about Miss Lovelace correctly, she got paid a upfront sum of money for
yes,
this.
Flat fee, right.
Now, the interesting thing I'm also seeing on the production notes, $22,500 was for the film. The other $25,000 in the budget was for the music.
And it was bad music. If we remember the 70s porn music.
Oh, porn man. Music in this century is even bad.
Yeah, well, it took special note back then. Everybody, do yourself a favor, and if nothing else, go click on the YouTube for Deep Throat, and I think they run the first 10 minutes or so of it, and you can hear that horrible music under the credits. Oh. And the credits are so bad. If you watch it when she's driving down the street in Fort Lauderdale, the camera cuts from the back seat over her shoulder to outside the car tracking next to it. And if you notice, her window goes up and down. And down, and so
mysteriously,
it's like production quality and continuity direction is non-existent.
When I'm looking at the cast, I'm betting that also is a crew.
Oh yes, I'm sure. The early porno movies, you know, at one point you held a boom arm for a microphone, and the next one you wore the boom arm sticking it somewhere.
Yeah, forget the best boy and the. And those, they just were not there.
You know, it's interesting in the production notes, under copyright, Deep Throat was released without a copyright notice. So they were sending it out to four-wall distribution across the country. So they would actually book a theater to run it so that all the rights, and they controlled all the copies of the film back when it first came out.
And I'm also noticing that Ebert came back and did a documentary on this film in 2005. And he noted that the original release of the film, a lot of the theaters were mob connected.
Oh yes. It was a four-wall contract, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
One of the interesting side notes here, Dutch television. I love Dutch television. I lived in Holland for 6 years. In February 23rd of 2008, the Nederlands Broadcasting, Public Broadcasting Corporation's VPRO, screened Deep Throat on national television as part of a theme night of the history of pornographic films. It aired after 10 p.m., but if you can imagine seeing Deep Throat on a public television channel, I gotta love the Dutch.
You have to. It's seen by almost a million viewers. The soundtrack was actually released in 72. Few copies exist today.
There's a good reason, because they were thrown against walls, I'm sure.
No, they say if you have a copy, it's worth about $300 to now.
Yeah.
And this is vinyl.
The tracks are listed here. Blowing Bubbles, if you all remember that, that was a great scene. And then they did a Things Go Better with Coke, too, which was, it's the real thing. But all the fun in the world.
Well, but that one was, it's I Like to Teach You All to Screw. I kind of want that version.
Yeah.
I need a theme song.
You're going to have to go out and find one of these CDs.
Yes, I am now.
Yes, I am. Well, without any further ado, let's talk a little bit about the man behind the story here. Gerald Damiano is the producer, if you will, of this, and he got into it pretty deep.
No pun intended.
Yeah, really. He's no longer with us. In 2008, he passed away at the age of 80. But good Italian Catholic boy from the Bronx. Not to mention, I'm sure, connected with certain underworld aspects. But got the money up, produced the film, and he was off and going. And he didn't let any grass grow under his feet, because not long after that, he got into another film, which we'll talk about in a minute. The Mitchell brothers, not to be left behind, decided that they would throw in their 1972 film. Also, just 6 months later, after Deep Throat, came behind The Green Door.
This film never did have the controversies that the came with Deep Throat.
Ooh, I don't know about that.
But
Deep Throat plowed a lot of ground.
Yeah, it did. Miss Lovelace claimed that she was coerced into doing the role. Don't think that Marilyn Chambers ever claimed that she was anything less than willing.
From a controversy point of view, you're right. But this had the first interracial sex scene ever in a film that it was, quote, mainstream.
Behind The Green Door, the interracial scene was the central point to the whole movie.
Well, let's see. If you take the abduction, when she was driving out to this coastal town, she got abducted, drugged, taken into this performance area, strapped down to a table, and then had many nasty things done to her. At the time, that was pretty controversial.
But nasty by our current definitions, not.
Tame by today's.
Yeah. The subject matter may have been controversial, but never did see the screaming of that we did with the Deep Throat earlier that year. Miss Chambers went on to a great film career, making several. But the interesting thing is, Miss Chambers was the Ivory Snow Girl.
That's right.
Before she made this movie.
As they say, 99 and 44 100ths percent impure.
taking up on the Ivory Snow slogan. Legal trouble again, like every porn movie in this era that tried to go mainstream, and even a lot that didn't go mainstream, the courts ended up in it.
This was a tough time for a lot of people to get past a lot of the blue laws, especially for exhibition of the film. You know, it was one thing to make it, but it was something else to run it and not get arrested. They were arresting managers and projectionists of movie theaters.
They was going after anybody they could to get these films shut down. So if they couldn't get the actual people that made it, they went after the people who were showing it who had no real control other than doing their jobs.
This was a particularly tough time in politics. We had Richard Nixon in the White House, and he had his henchmen that were out to clean up America. Of course, it would be nice to start at the top.
Yeah, but they did start at the top ultimately because we were in political chaos at this point as Nixon's administration was coming unraveled even then. But the Mitchell brothers were a colorful group themselves.
Jim and Artie Mitchell, they were San Francisco porn businessmen, or as they were called, X-rated bottom feeders.
Well, they were Californians, and California is still the seat of the porn industry. They were just some early innovators.
Mitchell brothers had the O'Farrell Theater in San Francisco, and it was a porn house for a lot of years, but literally in the back of it, they started producing movies to feed their own theater and their friends up and down the coast. What was interesting is in the mid-70s, low-level organized crime began making unauthorized copies of the Mitchells' movies. And the Mitchell brothers went back into court to retaliate against their product being stolen. So, you know, everything goes around, comes around.
Yeah. Organized crime saw this as a great thing to capitalize on because they didn't think anybody would dare stand up to them. One of the last films they produced, interesting, the Graffenberg spot in 85 was with the then still underage Tracy Lords.
Oh, yes. I know a lot about the Tracy Lords thing personally because I used to work with the guy that produced the movie.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't realize it. Well, he didn't realize that I knew. And I didn't realize it was him, but it was very interesting and when it all unfolded one day.
So the Mitchell brothers were indeed pioneers in this industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, so Gerald Damiano then decided to fire back another round with The Devil and Miss Jones in 1973. And this dealt in a whole lot of new areas to expand on his success with Deep Throat. He went off to explore while lying in a bathtub. Justine slits her wrist, dying quietly as the water fills with her blood and where her soul goes from there.
And this is a bit of a psychedelic film with some really weird sequences going on sometimes. Miss Jones finds herself in limbo.
And with Harry Reams, of all people.
Harry's back again.
Justine was played by Georgina Splevin. She was 36 when she made the movie, and we didn't hear much from her after that.
Well, 36 was an incredible age for somebody in that industry today, and then it was just really because Chambers and Lovelace both were much younger actresses. But this was...
But she started on Broadway. She was in Guys and Dolls, Sweet Charity, and The Pajama Game, and so this was quite a change for her career.
Well, now, it was the 10th most successful film of 73. This is interesting. It was a 10th highest grossing film in that year with $15 million. It was behind Paper Moon and Live and Let Die with Roger Moore.
Well, okay, that's pretty good company to keep.
That is really good company to keep. This was a X-rated movie that was not X-rated for any reason other than it had blatant sex in it.
You know, it was, as you said, psychedelic.
It was indeed. So this was 73.
And then back in the 80s, VCA, which is a home video company, came out with Devil and Miss Jones 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and probably 110 by now.
Well, no. Now we have The Devil and Mrs. Jones 2, The Devil's Agenda, The Resurrection, The New Devil and Mrs. Jones. It's its own industry now.
It's a franchise.
Yes.
After the success of that, then other people started to throw into it.
We will be right back after this message.
Hi, this is Woody, producer of the Kinky Cast. I just want to thank all our listeners for all the great comments we've got back from you. You know, this costs money, And since our staff is all volunteer, and we do this as a labor of love since we're all members of the Kinky community, one of the problems that we have is paying for bandwidth, server space, and even keeping our equipment up to speed. Our studio equipment is old, but it works, and we just need to keep it working. If you feel that you could donate a few bucks to keep us alive, that would be great. Everyone here and the listeners will appreciate the quality episodes that we can bring you every week. As we start the new calendar year, we have great stuff planned, and I want everybody to benefit from the educational aspects, the entertainment aspects, and the really important people that have something to say. So join us in the new year. Go to kinkycast.com and click on the donate button.
And now back to Woody and the Beast.
And then came Emmanuel.
Emmanuel was a remake of an earlier film, but the earlier film really didn't go far. And I don't have my notes in front of me on the earlier film. But this film was interesting in that it was Columbia Pictures distributed this film.
So that's pretty mainstream.
Yes, this is a company that all of the theater companies were used to dealing with for their films. And this was just in the catalog with everything else. It was Emmanuel. And this was a porn film. It's softcore, but it was porn. You can still find it occasionally on late night TV in various forms, edited down greatly.
Well, it's considered French softcore porn.
French. Oui, oui.
Mm-hmm. It was, strangely enough, it was shot in Thailand and France between 1973 and 4. So it's kind of back in that same golden era, but with a completely different twist.
Completely different twist. This is a film that really made this much more palatable to many, many viewers, because this was a positive female-centered film, whereas the earlier films, Devil and Mrs. Jones, had a flawed woman who commit suicide. The Behind the Green Door, we had a woman that was effectively raped to get her agreement to end the film. And Deep Throat was a woman that was totally out of control. Emmanuel, though, was a little different. She was a positive role model, if you can say a positive role model, for women in cinema.
In the U.S., it was released as an X-rated feature with the tagline, X was never like this.
Now, they also note that, that this was in response to Last Tango in Paris, which had some explicit sexual scenes in it.
Butter will never be the same after that.
No, Butter will never be the same. This is a film of nothing but sex, whereas The Last Tango had a bit more of a plot in it.
I remember going to see Last Tango in Paris when I was, I was legal age, but I was quite young. And I took my girlfriend. It was the first time I had ever seen anal sex. And Marlon Brando was doing it.
And first time many people seen anal sex.
Yes. I would say.
This was a much more relaxed period, but we now go over the story of
1975, and the French and the Germans got together to produce this, which is an interesting combination.
But again, this film was distributed by a real distribution company in the United States when Allied Artists took it up. It was a smaller house, but still it was a significant, took this on. But the history, the story of O, of course, is based on the Pauline Reggae book from 54.
There's an interesting thing here. Running time is 105 minutes if it's uncut, 97 minutes if it's cut. So a couple of choice scenes were taken out of it for the mainstream release. But if you find the video that runs 105 minutes, it's the original.
It was the British just do not like this film.
Well, the story of O was such a landmark for our lifestyle because it's the dealing with the training of a slave. Before this film, obviously there was the book, The Story of O, but the film made it real to a lot of people. And when you actually see what she went through for the training, for slave training, a lot of people were taken back and said, oh, this is just, you know, really sick.
But she was such a willing participant. I'll have to research the leading actress, Corinne Clary, and see what happened to her.
Meanwhile,
this is the grandfather of the marriage of Hollywood in the porn industry. This is where it was perfected.
So in 1984 came Caligula.
And let me read the cast. It stars Malcolm McDowell, Helen Mirren, yes, you know her, Queen Elizabeth, Peter O'Toole, John Gielgud, and a few others. This film had real production going on.
Well, this was a Bob Guccione film, the producer of Penthouse.
But we had a total cast here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody, we had production, we had everything. The budget was $17.5 million.
To do a period piece, you know, it runs 156 minutes, shot in Italy, the UK, and the United States. And it did, you know, reasonable box office. You know, it made $23 million. Not huge revenues for a major motion picture. It was so off the beaten path again. You know, you're playing to vanilla audiences in mainstream theaters.
This is about the Roman Emperor. Gore Vidal wrote the screenplay.
$200,000 he made.
$200,000 for the screenplay. But this movie was released to a lot of theaters. This was seen by a lot more than any of our other films, just by the magnitude of it and the cast.
Malcolm McDowell, he always plays kind of a sick and twisted evil guy. He's the born monster who serves as the film's anti-hero.
Yeah, definitely anti-hero.
Mm-hmm. Let's go real mainstream here for a minute.
Well, what happened was we entered into the age of HIV, and everything's really, sex got very quiet. We didn't deal with sexual topics much anymore. So we leave the golden era of porn with Caligula in the early 80s, and then we get quiet. We still have some films coming out with very sexual topics.
So in 1986, they slipped this one into the main box office on us, called 9.5 Weeks. And I think a lot of us remember that one. We had Mickey Rourke and Kim Basinger just set the screen on fire. I know when I saw it, the scenes where they're sitting by the refrigerator playing with the food, where she gets scarves tied around her wrist and blindfolded, and then he runs the ice down her. I mean, I almost fell out of my chair in the theater. That left such an impression on me.
Oh, it was an incredible movie. The book was really short that it was based off of, a just thin paperback. But this was just a movie. But Roark, 10 or 11 years later, reprised this role in another 9.5 Weeks, a lesser-known, lesser-interesting movie, and had a different female lead, because Basinger had far moved on from this film by this point.
We will be right back after this message.
On the phone with us is Midori from San Francisco. How are you?
I'm doing good.
You have a big event coming up.
I sure do. I've been doing this for over a decade. It's called AIDS Life Cycle.
And what is that?
It's this amazing experience. It's a 7-day bicycle ride for 2,500 cyclists riding from San Francisco to Los Angeles. And there are 600 of us roadie volunteers. I'm one of the volunteer roadies. And what we do, we cycle, we pedal, we cry. It hurts. It's amazing. It's beautiful. It's fantastic. And do this to raise funds and awareness for critically needed HIV services and education.
And how can our listeners help with this?
See, the thing is, I'm fundraising too, and this year my fundraising has been really, really challenged, and I need your help. I'm sick of my friends getting sick. I'm also sad from various long-term survivors dying from, quote, heart attack, quote, cancer, and it's all HIV related. I'm also frustrated with the ongoing lack of education. So here's what I would love to get help in. One, I'll be doing all my Twitters and social media, so cheer me on as I post photos from the road. That's one. And I'll be wearing silly bunny hats. And then two, donate to my AIDS Life Cycle fundraising, because they have 70 cents to the dollar is going to services. And there are people that are living longer and able to live a healthy life because of this. And there are people that are not serial converting or becoming positive, and are people are having smarter sex because of the programs that are funded by AIDS Life Cycle. So I hope all of you out there will help me out.
Okay, listeners, go to the KinkyCast homepage. Look for the button that says AIDS Life Cycle Donate Now. Push the button and it will take you right to the place where you need to drop a few bucks into a Midori's cup for AIDS awareness.
Thank you so much.
And now back to Woody and the Beast.
And so then roaring down to the next decade, in 1994, we end up with a comedy thriller, of all things, called Exit to Eden.
The Anne Rice novel, this was when Anne was beginning to dabble in porn. This was a very mainstream book with no porn in it, unlike her later beauty series, which was very explicit. The sex in this was nowhere near as explicit as her vampire series even. It dealt with BDSM, had a heavy BDSM overtone.
And this is directed by Gary Marshall, who is Laverne and Shirley and all those light and fluffy things that we know from television.
Well, it was funny. I mean, you got Rosie O'Donnell and Dan Aykroyd in it.
And Dana Delaney.
Now, Dana was playing the sexy character for sure. And remember, she's just coming off of China Beach.
Right.
Where she was definitely hot in.
Mm-hmm.
So she was playing a dominatrix running this island resort where fantasies become reality.
Gee, sounds like a fun place to go.
It does indeed. But it's a funny movie, but it got people talking a little bit about this BDSM stuff, but it was very humorous and tongue-in-cheek, the conversations.
Rosie O'Donnell and Dan Aykroyd. Okay, there you go.
But the BDSM world got explored a little deeper when we looked at one of our legendary characters when we get to the 2000 film, Quills. Again, this is a Fox film.
This was fairly mainstream.
So let's look at the cast. Jeffrey Rush, Kate Winslet, yep. Joaquin Phoenix, sure. And Michael Caine.
That's real Hollywood material there.
That's serious Hollywood material. This was after Kate did Titanic, is that right?
Yes, it was. And so she was still a name. And for those of you who don't know the story of the Marquis de Sade, this was the movie.
This was the movie. This was his life story, including the really dark parts of his life when he was imprisoned in the asylum, but more so for the fact he put his interests onto paper. And he wrote, and he wrote, and he wrote. Justine was one of his great masterpieces that we call today. And the Marquis is a very tortured character.
He's a funny character. I love the way it was played in the movie, because every time they would try to shut him down, he thought of a new way to exploit himself.
Every time.
This is a good romp. If you want to just enjoy a little bit of where we all came from, meet the Marquis de Sade in Quills.
And the Marquis later became Captain Barbossa in the Pirates of the Caribbean. And then he also was the King's speech therapist in The King's Speech, was that movie. So
yes.
Mr. Rush had an interesting entry into big-time cinema.
Okay, we move on a couple years, and probably one of the landmark films for the BDSM community was The Secretary, or just Secretary.
Secretary is not the secretary, his secretary. Maggie Gyllenhaal makes her really large screen.
Across from James Spader.
Across from James Spader.
Yeah. Boy, I remember when I saw this on the big screen, it was great because I was right in the middle of the scene up in the Bay Area, and a bunch of our community went to see it at the same time. It was great.
Well, it was. Spader really did the number on Miss Gyllenhaal in this movie. Of course, she did a number on herself, too, several times. One of the things that we have to remember, a lot of these films still feature flawed females, and Miss Gyllenhaal definitely was, her character was struggling with considerable issues throughout this film.
Oh, she was a cutter.
She was a cutter. She was had conflicts with her family and so forth. And so this is a bit of a dark story. It has some wonderful humorous moments, though.
Let's see. I think the key line, assume the position, was one of my faves.
Yes, yes, yes.
The budget for this movie was $4 million, and the box office is $9.3 million.
I wonder if that is accurate today.
Well, I'm sure it has gone up from there, but this was a good one, so everybody do catch that. This is one I keep in my library because it is a...
It's a fun film.
It is a fun film. And speaking of fun films, in 2006, The Short Bus. Not a lot of people saw this one.
Well, this was an art house film for sure.
It was. It came to me on video. A gay friend of mine gave it to me and said, you got to see this. And it is a really interesting film with the dysfunctionality of people, and that's why it's called Short Bus.
Uh-huh.
And the movie is pivotal around a sex therapist who is trying to deal with all the maladies of all her patients. And each one plays out. And I will tell you, one of the most interesting minutes in the film is the credits, the title sequence. They build a miniature New York City out of paper mache or something, and the camera flies down the streets and over the houses. And it's just a breathtaking, beautifully created piece. And then the whole story starts to unfold by a gay filmmaker who's telling his story and contemplating suicide and all these sorts of things. Very interesting story. There is a scene where the sex therapist goes into a house. I'm not going to call it a party house because it's a house where community members gather and there's an orgy going on and there's every kind of pansexual activity you can think of in one place. And she's just overwhelmed by it.
This is very much got a documentary feel to it because the sex scenes are real, but they're not nowhere near as scripted as the sex industry's current version of the sex scene. These are real people that are featured in this mockumentary, I guess would be the correct term, because it's not a documentary, but it's definitely a worth-watching film. It's directed by John Cameron Mitchell, so do look it up, Short Bus, all one word.
Sleeping Beauties was a bomb. Did you see that?
I remember Sleeping Beauty, but I'm trying to remember.
It went backwards in the money business. The budget was $3 million U.S. It made $36,000 in the U.S. and $300,000 Australian dollars in Australia. So it was a bomb.
It looks like the story rambles around.
Yeah, I couldn't get through the plot.
But it has sex.
Yeah, and it ends up with necrophilia.
Looking at the cast, nobody is.
I think we should toss this one.
Sleeping Beauty.
Okay, let's rewind for a minute, Beast. We started in 1972 with Linda Lovelace and crew, but we have one that predates that.
Yes, this Hollywood actually tackled, I won't say porn, tackled open sexuality in a storyline much a couple of years earlier.
You know, they're calling this a British historical drama horror film.
Well, it's based on a real event in 17th century, I believe, and it is The Devils. Now, who released that show, that movie?
Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers, released by the big boys. And it had Oliver Reed and Vanessa Redgrave.
And it was directed by Ken Russell, a big name at that time.
Yeah, so it was a major film. It never went anywhere in the United States. You have a hard time finding a copy of it. Listeners, if you have a copy of The Devils from 1971, please contact me. I would like to take it off of your hands.
Or at least borrow it.
Yes. There was a VHS issued in 1995, and it is about a monastery gone terribly wrong, about a priest who misinterprets his orders, and it is an extremely convoluted film from what I understand. It was banned in the UK by 17 localities. Judith Crist called it a grand fiesta for sadists and perverts.
Ooh, that's me.
Another one called a very bad film indeed. Heller is one of the best director of foreign film in the Venice Film Festival, despite being banned in that country.
No contradictions here so far, right?
The United States National Board of Review awarded Ken Russell Best Director for The Devils, and it was called his most brilliant cinematic achievement, regarded as his most distasteful and offensive work. So, yes, if you have a copy of The Devils, please, please reach out to us. We love to see this film. We have heard of it. We have seen some of the stories, but we have yet to actually lay our eyes on it.
And so that takes us down to the big event for you. What do you got there?
Probably the newest entry into the sex and cinema category. This is one that it's an art house film. It's definitely a very interesting film. It's not a fast-paced film, though. But let me read the cast. We start out with Stellan Skarsgård, who we remember from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the original European version, and more recently in the Thor and the Avengers films. Then we go to Shia LaBeouf from Transformers fame, Christian Slater, who just most recently played Moses, Connie Nielsen, Jamie Bale, Uma Thurman, and William Devoe.
That is quite a cast.
The Nymphomaniac. Yeah, it's quite a cast. The movie opens with Joe, J-O-E, who's a woman, being found beaten, bloodied in a alleyway by a very reclusive gentleman who takes her in and nurses her back to health over a period of days. And this is Joe telling her story to her benefactor. And Joe is a self-diagnosed nymphomaniac. The movie is divided into a series of vignettes. The volume one, yes, there's two volumes to this film, has five vignettes, and the second film have four additional vignettes. Joe's adventure from her early years to much later in her life, and I'll give you a tantalizing, there's a train sequence where she is in a contest with her teenage friend to see how many men they have sex with on the train. Well, let me rephrase that. Passengers, women are eligible. And the scene ends with Joe winning by giving a blowjob to a reluctant married man. Then there are a series of other sequences. And this is just a very laid-back film. The sex is not going to get you all hot and bothered. It's going to definitely make you think, though, about sexy thoughts and about the nature of sex and the nature of relationships. The Nymphomaniac, it's a 2013 two-part art film directed by Lars von Trier. Director's cut, it's 5 hours long.
Goodness.
We're all coming up to the next entry into Sex and Cinema, which will be
February 14th, 2015, St. Valentine's Day.
Yes, when we have 50 Shades of Grey coming, like it, hate it. It's going to own that weekend, we know. There's nothing else that can touch it that weekend, I'm quite sure. Get your tickets early.
And take all your kinky friends.
Take all your kinky friends. Be respectful of the other moviegoers and watch the film.
I'm planning on taking my Polly family with me, and we're all going to hold hands or do something and just try to put the vanillas a little bit off pace there.
Hey, you got a good idea. I may drag my harem out in black leather and...
Hey, you know, got to walk the walk and talk the talk.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. This might be really interesting. So, listeners, if you have films that you would like to add to our list, please let us know. A title and a little bit of information so we can dig it up. We'll be happy to discuss it on our next volume of Sex in the Cinema.
We'll dig into other works that have come along that have been mainstream, things like the European version of Eyes Wide Shut, the Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman movie. The European version is much more interesting than the U.S. release.
Oh, yes. And we have several films that just we did not have time to get to today. Quite a few films. And we promise we'll get back to this.
And let us know what you think about the show, the way we did it. And if there's comments, we'll certainly take those into effect and get that into the next version of the show. So this has been Beast Siskel and Woody Ebert.
And we'll come at you again.
And between us, I think we got four thumbs up. See you next time.
You have been listening to episode 51 of The Kinky Cast. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. Next week we have Lee Harrington talk about Rope, his book, and many other things. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and all our kinky crew, I'm Max.